So the Numenoreans are granted extraordinarily long life, life in the 300s and 400s of years, for example, but they're not granted eternal life. And this is the little spot of rot that eventually destroys the entire apple. Because the Numenoreans are friends with the elves, they see the elves, and they're jealous of the elves. And first, they turn those energies into conquest. They conquer all of Middle-earth, and they sail everywhere that can be sailed. But then, they become more and more greedy for eternal life. They begin embalming their dead, for example, rather than letting them return to the earth. And they begin memorizing the names of ancient kings and focusing more on the past than on the present. It might help here to note that Tolkien once said that the Numenoreans were Egyptians. And to make that work, you have to think about the focus on death and the afterlife in ancient Egypt. And then also there's a nice kind of parallel. The Numenoreans are the Egyptians. When they come to Middle-earth and settle there, they become the Romans. Essentially, the torch of civilization passes and build huge stoneworks, but are somewhat less focused on death. And then the Rohirrim are the Anglo-Saxons, the lower men who've come along later, who don't have that level of culture. In any event, the Numenoreans become so strong and so great that they are able to conquer Sauron. They bring a fleet to Middle-earth to conquer Sauron at the request of some of the elves to help them fight, and Sauron surrenders to them that they're so strong. Now, this is Sauron with the One Ring, I might add. That's how powerful he is. But he surrenders to the Numenoreans, and very stupidly, their king takes him back to Numenor as a captive. And of course, then, he corrupts everyone, starts having human sacrifices in the temple and burning the white tree down and all of this, persecuting those people who like elves. And he eventually convinces the king, Ar-Pharazôn the Golden, and you can see the word pharaoh is right in there almost. He convinces Ar-Pharazôn the Golden that it's a really good idea to go attack the elves at the Valar in the Blessed Land. So Ar-Pharazôn sails off to conquer the gods, and he lands in the Blessed Land. And that's when Eru, the one god, shows up the second time in the Silmarillion. The Valar lay down their guardianship of the world, and Eru squashes Numenor. He sinks it to the bottom of the ocean. It's covered over with a great wave, and the world changes from a flat earth, where you could just sail west and end up at the Blessed Land, to a round earth, where the Blessed Land is no longer attached. You have to sail the straight road to get there, and normal human beings can't do that. So this is the big change. And again, it's that theme of loss. There used to be an elvish paradise in the West that you could maybe sail to, even if you weren't allowed to, and you could die seeing it. And Tolkien has some poems about this, about mariners who glimpse Elvenhom before they die. Now it's removed from the world entirely. And the land of the gift has become a punishment. A few people escape from Numenor, and they come back to Middle-earth, and they found Gondor and Arnor, and they're the ancestors of Aragorn and so forth. There's a final section in the Silmarillion called Of the Rings of Power in the Third Age, and it's actually the one that people have read if they don't read the whole Silmarillion. It basically gives the setup that you already had in the appendices and through the Council of Elrond that explains where the rings came from and how people used them in the war against Sauron. I'm not going to go over all that plot now, so I want to spend the last couple minutes of this lecture talking about why the Silmarillion is so significant and why you should try to read it, as difficult as it is. And the first thing I want to point to is the style, which can be very off-putting. When the book starts out, in the beginning there was and has that kind of calque on the Bible, in other words, a rewriting of the Bible into another idiom. It can be problematic, it can be difficult to read, and certainly the characters don't have the same sort of down-home speaking approach that the hobbits do in The Lord of the Rings. But I want to read a small passage that you can see the beauty that Tolkien could achieve when he was trying to write in the high style, and also you can see how this might connect up with some Anglo-Saxon literature.